Renee here at Unsupervised Learning, your easy listening podcast for bleeding edge open source tech.
No, you I was gonna say, it's like one thing I was kind of reviewing the video. So like, keep at like definitely like whenever you ask questions or whenever you kind of like kind of pry at something, like the one that gets in my mind is still the parameters, when we start talking about parameters, because that to me, like in my head, I'm like, I would have never even thought of like even talking about it, because it's like, oh, that's not technical, everyone knows what parameters are. Like, of course that's not true, but like you had that realization, like, and I was just like, I'm like oh, that's such a, like, that was one of those moments where I was like, because you kind of picked that, it's like, what is a parameter? And you're like, oh yeah, we could, let's talk about what that is. So
I've got a whole list of like things. I had sent you something. What did I send you?
I know you sent me a couple things. I'm pulling up the Notion in case there's stuff there.
Foundational models.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What's a foundational model?
Oh, that's a great question, because like this is definitely something that has kind of like grown out of like foundational models are kind of talked about as these the really good models that we take and then build on top of. But in reality, there's not like, as least as far as I know, there isn't like a real definition of what makes a foundational model a foundational model. It's just kind of like a vibe of just being like, oh yeah, this is like a really good model. So we're going to call that foundational model, and we can fine tune or do variations from that foundational model. And so
ChatGPT, like, is ChatGPT a foundational model?
Yeah. So you could almost say GPT-4 or GPT-2, you know, GPT 3.5, you know, I think Turbo would fit in there too, would be like a foundational model. And then you like might do, you would do some fine tuning, like instructional fine tuning to make it more chat like, but like it's in essence, the model underneath it, it's kind of like the foundation is the thing that you start from. And in general, we talk about foundational models as being like really powerful. Like for the record, like you could totally, you know, like take some code and like train a model on like your MacBook. And like, it could be technically like from pure data, like a pure vanilla model that you made. And I guess you could call that a foundational model, but most people wouldn't. They're usually talking about like big kind of systems and stuff like that that you're gonna build on top of.
My next question, like by default, is a foundational model kind of like massive?
It's kind of turned into that pretty much. Like I'm trying to think of like when it really started being used. And it's only been like the past like few years or something. Like I'm probably gonna get this wrong, because I'm just gonna say, oh, it's been used since, you know, the past like 15 years or, you know, 40 years, you know. But like at least from like everything I'm thinking about and stuff like that that come out, usually it's been as the models have grown in size. And we're talking about like large language models specifically when we're talking about foundational models. These large language models have gotten large enough where they're kind of like, oh, it's really hard for any one even organization to train these things. And so there's kind of like the idea that you need a lot of resources, whether that's, you know, computers essentially, and money and time. So that's kind of where, I guess, like, they're almost like one of those, like, oh, here's the great foundational model. And like, you know, we can take that down and like do something interesting with it. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know why I asked that. I literally don't know where that, oh yes. Is BERT a foundational model? What's BERT?
Ooh, oh yeah. So BERT. So I did a lot of work with BERT. Yeah. And so if I'm gonna get the acronym wrong, it's an acronym, yeah. Or whatever the one that you can pronounce that's spelled out. I think that's acronym. It's a bidirectional encoding something transformer.
Representations. I've just Googled
precision.
It.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Yeah, and so this is actually came from Google. I think it was 2018. If I remember this right, because 2017 would be kind of like the birth of the transformer, which is what basically all these large language models are currently being built on top of. But basically, it was a transformer, essentially a large, like, I'd argue it's a large language model. Some people, depends how they define large language models, but it's a language model. And it was trained in a way that we talked about, like for example, like ChatGPT and a lot of these like autoregressive models that basically generate word for word, you know, one word at a time. A lot of them are trained in a way that it tries to guess what the next word is. BERT had a different kind of structure where instead of guessing what the next word is going to be. They had a sentence and they would, what they called mask, basically cover up some of the words for the model. And the model had to guess what is the missing word in this sentence based on all the other words around it. And so this has some interesting parts into it, why it's really useful for a lot of natural language processing tasks.
I swear I did that in school, right?
What's that? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you like task. You have like a test, you have like a little blank spot, and you're like A, B, C, D, and you're like, which word is this kind of thing? And you fill it in, right? Yeah, that's basically it, except they have a lot more choices, you know. They kind of like don't have four choices, they have like every possible subword, some kind of token, basically a part of a word. And then it basically said, hey, what's the missing word that's in here? And what's interesting about that is that structure, this is a bi-directional part, is that to know what the word is, you don't look at just the previous words in the sentence, but also the words further down in the sentence. And so you can use all of that together as context to guess what that one missing word is. And so when you have it structured like that, you can do things like, the idea of it was to basically have it learn context around what is this, you know, this missing word that can guess correctly. Can it learn the context, you know, learn the context that's around the missing word? And so in that way, you can kind of take a word and say, oh, what's the context of this word? And so this is where BERT was really useful in something called embeddings, where basically embeddings are kind of like a special mathematical representation of a word. And the mathematical representation is something called a vector, and basically just a list of numbers. But the point is that was kind of like the point, well, not the point, but one of the things that BERT ended up being really useful for is creating these embeddings. And it's relatively small by like today's standards and stuff like this, and it could be something that you can like fine tune as well. You can use it, basically the vanilla part of it, but the important part is that embedding part. You can use that for a bunch of different tasks.
I was going to ask about named entity recognition. Oh, okay. Because that I remember when I used to be on Slack and I'd see people saying no, I'd always just be like no, and I had no idea of what that sits in, like what is that related to.
Yeah, should we come back to that one then?
Yeah,
okay, cool. So going back to so that was kind of what BERT is with kind of like this this fill in the blank, you know, and you can see the whole sentence. An autoregressive model, the way they are trained is to, it only sees the previous words. And so that's an important aspect of it, is that if you think about it, BERT and the way it was trained, it's not as easy to reproduce at a generation, like text generation, because basically it's trying to guess what the next word is amongst a bunch of words versus something like autoregressive, where it's predicting the next word. So you can have it generate the next word and then feed in that word into it, then produce the next word, and so on and so on.
Is that suggesting that autoregressive is better for like, is generative AI? And what's the other one?
But what's
BERT again?
So BERT is technically it's, so this is where I'm getting into technical words. Usually we talk about it as encoder decoder models. And basically you can think of there's an encoder and a decoder piece. And so there's a couple ways you can have this. You can have an encoder only, you can have a decoder only, and then you can have an encoder decoder together. And so the idea of encoding is that you can take in inputs, like say a bunch of words, either previous words or words within a sentence, encode that to basically get a, we talk about like a, as a context, as being kind of like, oh, here's some information about whatever the inputs were. And that feeds out into a, again, mathematical representation of what these words were. And so that's an encoder part. And that's kind of like the part of BERT is the encoding part. It's basically, it was meant bi-directional, meaning that it could look at words, not just before it, but also after it. And then also it was encoding, where basically it was encoding into a new, an embedding essentially, like in some kind of mathematical representation of what those words represent. And so that's kind of like the idea of the encoder part. A decoder part takes a representation and then can take that representation and output usually it's going to be like the next tokens, some kind of embedding, some mathematical representation of what that, this is where it gets really like, you know, technical, and I'm trying to like not to get too deep, but basically it's taking in this and this mathematical representation that can be fed in and output a essentially usually a single, like usually a single token, a single word. And so you have declutter only models, which are things similar to ChatGPT and other autoregressive models. What makes it really confusing is that you can also have an encoder decoder stuck together, and you can also have something where it encodes words or whatever the input is. I say words because that's usually what we're talking about, like text, but it could also be other things like images and stuff or audio, and then outputs what the decoder would put out. So you're kind of like these two little blocks that can be stuck together. So hopefully that isn't super confusing, but like kind of the idea of the difference.
My other question is, are the vectors, are they static? Are they stock? So are they the same? Like, does the word, so dog, like 0.12, that's just my fake made up number for dog. Is that the same across models?
Or is that? So this one is almost definitely, most likely not. Like because it's almost like maybe an analogy to this is kind of like how people's brains are like probably structured in a similar way, but like we all have a different way of like, if I say, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like if I say like a color, if I say like red, your red might be super bright red and mine might be closer to kind of like, I don't know, closer to a magenta or something like that. And someone else's red might be completely different from mine, kind of thing. It's a horrible analogy, but like that's kind of the idea.
No, it's great. That must be so frustrating though, for like, what would that be? Like ML ops, I guess? Like, is that a data thing? Is that a data cleanliness thing? Or
yeah. So ML ops is kind of this thing that's have evolved over time. There's definitely a book up there that's like practical ML ops that's on my shelf. It's got a Dalmatian on it. It's basically a huge part of, so there's, what's the word for it? DevOps. That's kind of like where this evolved from. So MLOps is kind of a playoff of DevOps, where DevOps is talking about how do you basically, well, I'm not a DevOps person, so I'm going to probably missay something. But the DevOps part basically is about more on the software engineering side, making sure all these pieces work. MLOps is kind of like taking all of the machine learning pieces and making sure those all work. And so there's a bunch of parts with that. And this is where I'll say, I say machine learning ML ops, because this ML ops is not just like large language models. It's also like, I'll say like traditional classical. I wish I remember. There was a term that someone came up with, or I saw recently, and I was like, oh, I like that term, and I forgot what it is. But that traditional classical machine learning, that also would be covered in MLOps. Some people have referred to a specialization of MLOps, which is called LMOps, which I don't know how you're supposed to say, even it's adding more and more letters, I feel. But the short thing about like what is MLOps is basically saying, okay, like we have not just the model, but also like, oh, like we need to train the model. How do you make sure when you train the model, what data you're using, how are you using the same amount of data? When you produce a new version of a model, are you going to use the correct version? How do you make sure that works together? When the model, what we call it, goes stale, where let's say, for example, with like something like ChatGPT or Gemini or these other models, sometimes they're fine-tuned on more information. So like, you know, like they're only up to date for like 2023 and it's 2024, you know, you need to update it, like, you know, put more information into it. You need a new version, right? And so part of that operations is making sure you have the correct model. And some of these models are not, you know, we kind of talk about like ChatGPT, Gemini as if they're one thing, and it's most likely not. It's probably multiple different parts working together. So making sure all of that flows together as well. So you have to make sure you train it properly. And then also when you're training versus what we call inference, which we talked about before, basically when someone's using the model, like, you know, the average consumer, you know, is actually using the model, that's a different kind of structure than when you're training the model too. So that's kind of like the separation of all these different pieces. So
cool. I wanted to like reverse engineer, but like if I somewhere called Hume, and yeah, let me put it over here. It's empathetic AI to serve human well-being, interpret emotional expressions, and generate empathetic responses. And I find that fascinating. And I think that's a like an emotion categorizer, right? Like the whole thing in voice and also in text, that would be like based on trained on sentiment.
Yeah. So that definitely sounds like a sentiment. Like the thing that goes to my mind is sentiment analysis of basically that's is even before it predates like large language models and stuff like that, where you use machine learning to basically figure out, like, for example, if you had a review on your website of, is it a positive review or a negative review? Does this person feel angry about it versus, you know, positive about it? But, you know, that can kind of expand outward to even beyond text. I don't know if there was more to that question or if that makes sense, but yeah.
No, that makes heaps of sense. Because so I think about that, and then I think about, I don't know if I put it on Threads or Twitter or something like that. I was talking to someone about like cross-cultural sentiment analysis and sentiment passes and like the difficulties of, okay, for example, Australians say yeah nah yeah when they mean yeah, or they say nah yeah nah when they mean no. And how would you, it's just like, it's not something that I think has a direct answer. It's just, oh, look, that's paint from painting the other day. It's not something that has a direct kind of answer. It's more of just like, that seems like a problem to solve in, I don't know, LLM ops or ML ops or whatever.
Yeah. So you actually, Renee, you hit like this topic that is like really good to like realize. And the short answer is like, how would you know, like, the sentiment, like you said, like cross-cultural, but even like individual people have like, I'll give an extreme of this. And so not using text, but just using like, for example, every once in a while, you'll see something like in the research community, they talk about using like faces to determine like emotions.
Yes.
And what's interesting about that is I weren't even sure if people can do that reliably without any other context. And so what's interesting is that people have talked about this as being like, should we be using, you know, and it's not even like large language models, just like machine learning in general, be able to detect emotion? Because, you know, in some essence, like you can have the machine, you know, the model say, oh, this person's angry, but you really don't know. Going like in the really extreme version of this is there are models that have, how do I say this? Models that could detect, well, they claim that they would detect if you were gay or not. And right, which is also one of those things, is like that seems ridiculous from like a picture and stuff like this, like how would you be able to tell and stuff. And like the weird thing is that there can be some, like when they test this out and they, the research, they can see like if from their examples they can do this, but it's usually like, well, how did you deal with the data? If it's basically the way I explain, like with machine learning, it's machine learning doesn't learn like we learn. The way it learns essentially, and like learns in quotes here, when we train it, is it basically gives a bunch of examples of tests. There's a bunch of, like basically it kind of figures things out by us just giving a test. We can't actually say, oh, this is like, this is the things that you need to do to detect if it's a dog versus a cat. Basically you just have a bunch of examples of this. And it's kind of like if you gave a student like throughout the year, five different like practice tests. You did five bunch practice tests and they keep practicing and say, nope, you got this one wrong, try again. And you know, nope, you got this one wrong, try again, right? And the idea of hoping that the student would learn so they do better on the test. You can also have the student who maybe just doesn't want to learn, just try to memorize all those tests after seeing them over and over and over again. So when you're end of the year, where you're final, if you show one of those five tests that they've seen before, the student gets super great, you know, like does like 100%. You're like, oh, great. This student clearly knows the material. And you don't actually know if the student actually has learned the concepts that require, you know, basically so they could answer the test, or if that student just simply memorized all the answers. So sometimes that kind of research where they claim big things where like, oh, you can do this. And sometimes it's very subtle, but a lot of times it ends up being like, oh, their methodology wasn't, you know, proper. And again, a good rule of thumb is just being like, how would you do this as a person? Like, how would, you know, like, for example, detecting if someone is gay, you know, from their picture, you'd be like, how would you be able to do this? Like, this seems a little dubious in like the possibilities. And then I use that example because I'm glad you're laughing, because it should be ridiculous, right? But like, people have tried doing things like this. And the one big issue, so this is the kind of like where I say, oh, I use gay, like, and homosexuality as an example here, because in some countries that can be very like imagine a government that is not very, you know, you know, supportive of that, of homosexuality, could use something like this, that whether or not the tool even works, they just use it to basically say, you know, oh, to catch this kind of thing. It's like, well, your picture came up as being, you know, gay, so we're going to put you in prison or whatnot. These are the kind of issues that can happen. And so I use that example because I think most people, I hope most people would say, oh yeah, that seems ridiculous and it shouldn't be used in that way and it shouldn't be done at all, probably. But that's where emotion can also be very interesting too, because for example, if this is where we're kind of talking a little bit about biases and like machine learning, that kind of
I'm thinking about facial recognition and like people using them for potential shoplifting, or like, have you seen that? That's what I was just Googling just then. I was I just remembered.
I'm sure you can find this. There was at least one research group that was using pictures and determining if the person from the picture, if they were likely to have another crime. And it's one of those things where, especially like in the US, we have a disproportionate, you know, people's like different faces, different ethnicities that are imprisoned more often than others. And so when you take that data set, they were training off of mugshots, which, you know, now you have, you're not just saying, oh, like, well, these people were arrested and how many people were found guilty, like, and using that as your metric. You can train a machine learning model to do that, but does that say the thing that you want it to say? Or like, does it say what you think it's supposed to do? And in a lot of cases, you're like, well, you have to say, let's just pretend the machine learning is magic, which it's not, but let's just pretend it could do something like that. Even just starting with the fact that it could figure it out, your data might be flawed. Like, just because you have mugshots of people who are arrested and then finding out if they were found guilty, you have to rely on the fact that essentially that system, basically the justice system, let's say just US, just center with that, the justice system does a proper job and a good enough job that we want to emulate of someone being arrested and then actually being found guilty. And that's even going from the fact that who's even arrested to begin with. And so like, there's all these kind of extra factors. And like, I want to put that one out there because I hope that most people, including yourself, right, like, would feel like, yeah, this is wrong. Like, you shouldn't use pictures to determine if someone's going to have a crime. You know, like, they say, like, shoplifting, right? There's all these issues with that. But you turn it slightly, and somehow, sometimes people think it sounds about right. And this is, like, one of the things where could you, and this is kind of leading into something I talked about offline, but could you instead take, like, a picture and say, oh, should I give this person a job or not? You know, and it's like, well, what if I take a picture instead of a picture, feed it just text, like its resume or, you know, someone's resume or someone's, you know, previous attributes and stuff. And you can say, well, how would you train that? It's like, well, whether or not they got the job, we can say, here's some resumes that we came in. Here's the person who actually got the job, you know, and train it off that. And now you start basically building up these biases now that are maybe already inherent into the system. And now you're basically teaching the machine learning model to also learn these biases. And sometimes they're very subtle. Sometimes it's not super obvious where the bias, what we call like kind of like that leakage of information comes out from. And sometimes it's really obvious, like, you know, it's like, oh, clearly a picture would not be very good. But like, you can also have things like, you know, someone's name, you feed someone's name. The and Bloomberg. Now it's like, oh, exactly.
The Bloomberg, yeah. I knew you were talking about that. So was that only recent or did I only read it recently? It was a 7th,
I think, of March? That's like a week ago. Oh, 7th of March? So like about a couple weeks ago. I think it was making the rounds a week ago. Like it was starting to become a bigger
and
thing.
The kind of takeaways from that were essentially like, I'm pointing to you. So that you can tell me the takeaways.
Crack my knuckles, like, all right, here we go.
I was gonna say basically you can round up the news for me, and then I was gonna ask you if you've ever seen Charlie's Angels. The first Charlie's Angels.
from the what year was it?
I don't know, like it was Lucy Liu, Drew Barrymore, Cameron Diaz.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I actually is there more than one Charlie's Angel? Is there?
Sorry. There might be a second one.
Okay, that's the one I know of. That's why I was like, I'm like, oh, which one? And I'm like, so I'm like, is that the only? Like, that's the only one I know. Yes.
No, because I'm thinking about like, use cases for biometric data, and I start thinking about like, at what point would I be comfortable being like? Because we had the COVID facial, like I worked for that company with the facial app scanning. Oh, mm-hmm. And I think about, because the Charlie's Angels, they scanned their eyes, and that was like a security measure, that kind of thing, retinal scanning. But have you seen, it's somewhere in the US where it's like this billionaire, and she has the fingerprint for everything, get into her house, to get into her car. Like, I think she has a Porsche, and it's like, I'm going to have to find the video. And people in the comments of her TikTok are like, just cut off her hands. Like, oh my God. yeah, and then that makes me think about Neuralink, and like there's just so much. It's like a rabbit hole of
oh yeah. Yeah, oh man, we're diverging, we're kind of going into different directions. We can definitely go on that, but I want to make sure, which one do you want to talk about first? I guess like Bloomberg biases or
Bloomberg. Let's go back to,
okay,
Bloomberg.
Okay, come back to Charlie Angel cut off their hands biometrics. Yeah. We'll come back to that.
Awesome.
So going to the Bloomberg thing, you kind of asked, is it recent? And what's really fun is that the Bloomberg, I think it was an article research that they came out with first, is recent, but this is like old news. This is not something that is like, oh, this suddenly is a new thing that we have to be aware of. It's like, no, this has been something in data science, in machine learning for quite some time. This is where I will say there's a book, Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill.
Math Destruction.
It's great. It's great. And even Kathy O'Neill writes about WMDs, Weapons of Math Destruction. And this is where I'm like, I'm trying to pull it off. Like, I definitely like looked it up recently because I'm like wanted to make sure I remembered it. But of course, I forgot this part. She has a definition of like what it makes a WMD, you know, in data science and machine learning. And this book was written in 2016, which again, it's like 8 years ago. But even then, it's like not like new stuff. But she defines a WMD as basically being something that can not just, first, is it correct, but also is it going to be, what's it called? Is it going to scale a lot of harm? So if you have something.
I put it in the chat. So WMDs are weapons of math destruction, mathematical algorithms that supposedly take human traits and quantify them, resulting in damaging effects and the perpetuation of bias against certain groups of people.
And that's the key part, the perpetuation of bias. One thing I think people have to realize, whether it's AI or whatever tool we use, that we do have biases in our society. And in general, I think people realize that these biases are things like, oh, these are not good things. You know, we shouldn't have these biases. We should try to remove these kind of things. But one thing that machine learning AI can do is really perpetuate these biases and sometimes turn them into, you know, really turn them up a notch. Like a little bias turns into a really strong bias. If you suddenly had, kind of talking about our if this, let's say image recognition of whether someone's a shoplifter or someone's going to cause a crime, if that was suddenly like put out everywhere and being like used continuously, that can cause a lot of extra bias, right? There's a potential for a lot of harm to a lot of people, and basically turning up this, you know, bias really up a lot. So what I was getting at was that the Bloomberg thing, I can't remember exactly their methodology because I'm mixing it up with like past stuff, but I think they feed just the names and they like of a job applicant, and they were seeing if ChatGPT, how they break down. I think they did a few things, but I think that was one of them, right?
Yeah, it's behind a paywall.
I know. I know. Bloomberg has some great pieces. I think it has some great pieces, but it's like behind paywalls. I'm like, oh yes, I have to have the subscription part. And then like, even if you do, you have to pay for it, or like you have to remember to sign in.
I mean, I wish we knew. We could make it up.
I will say I know this one piece that they definitely were looking at least the names, and they at least talked about that part. I wish I remembered this.
That's the thing. Information leak. I read this yesterday, and it's just out of my brain. Like, I don't know where it's gone in the ether, but I still have like all of the lyrics to the Vengabus. Like, that's in there.
I love the random going on a tangent, but I love the random like. You're like, oh my gosh, I remember this thing that someone said like 12 years ago. Yeah. And like, it's like clear as day. And you're like, but I can't remember the thing I had like earlier today, like, or like hours ago.
Yeah.
This is also the nature of us talking a little bit, like, you know, here and there.
Oh, yeah.
Is good. But anyway, before we lose track completely, Bloomberg, feeding the name. And basically, I think they were saying something along the lines of, where you fed either the name or information and basically seeing how ChatGPT would, like, would you hire this person or not? And basically they showed they saw that there was bias in there from people. And I think this is where people will say, well, you know, I've heard this camp before. People say, well, you need to train the model to be better. You just need to give it more examples and all this stuff. And we've seen this in machine learning too. And so we've seen this where you have something like a resume and you have someone's name, you know, usually resumes got someone's name at the top and then has like their information, you know, like where they went to school, what jobs they have, what skills, what's their hobby, you know, what's their dog's name, maybe if you're interested in that kind of thing. But like they have a bunch of information, right? And so they're like, oh, it was rejecting, you know, let's say it was for a position and it was rejecting more females than males, you know, and they're like, there's no reason to arbitrarily, you know, like in this way, reject this many people who are just, you know, basically same qualifications, but they're just female. And it's like, okay, well, let's take off their name. Like, you know, take off their name. We replace he and she, you know, things that would be gender stuff, remove that stuff. And they train the machine learning algorithm to do this. And you would think, okay, we solved it, right? We figured it out, right? Like, should be good now. It still would bias towards hiring a male than a female candidate. And the reason why is because there's subtle things in the way we write, like just culturally speaking. Not saying like, you know, like all women do this, all men do this, but like culturally we do different things. And this can also expand out not just from gender, but also like, you know, ethnicities and stuff and backgrounds, you know, whether you're a child of an immigrant could be something you just end up having different kind of, I'd say speech patterns, but like written patterns and stuff like this. And these things, the whole point of machine learning is to find patterns. It's and this is machine learning, and I'll make it clear, in AI, right, all AI stuff, yeah, is to find patterns. And so if you have this data coming in, and the key part was you have this data coming in that's going to find patterns in there, and if you have a metric that basically like of all your past people you've hired are like male, you know, and you use that essentially as your guiding kind of like metric, no matter what you do with this machine learning algorithm, it's going to start going towards male. You have to address the first initial bias, like of like, how do you even decide what a good candidate is? And even when you decide that, the model can still find subtle patterns. And this is where, you know, a lot of things, you know, people say, oh, you know, we'll just use AI, we'll just flip the switch and like, you know, lean back and just let things happen. And it's like, it can be helpful, but we also have to have, you know, someone in the back and be like, hey, like, is this making sense? Are we, and doing some checks, like, hey, like, preferably someone who's independent, but like, at least, you know, someone who's going, hey, is this going to perpetuate bias? And is it doing bias, even if we think it's not going to perpetuate it? So there's a whole bunch of, like, I literally have a book next to me that's called, I just pulled it up, like, practical
awareness. I was about to ask, like, resourcing and stuff. So I remember Emily of Hugging Face mentioned that they developed a data set or a model, I'll have to go back and watch, for exactly that in job postings and in like inclusive languaging, that kind of thing. But right. I've used something exactly that. It's in Australia, it's called OutHire. And it was like, as I wrote the job description, it started highlighting words and it was like, this is more male coded, this is more, and I was like, dang. But I've done a certification from, I put it in the chat, text.io, and I'm a big fan of color, like brightly colored branding. Uh-huh. So I remember a few years ago, I saw them and I was like, I don't know what they do, but they look nice. And I've kind of followed...
Pretty colors are nice, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was very simple. It was like, it's pretty. But they do a lot of research and kind of integration with different places. That's very wishy-washy, doesn't make sense. But it's like that kind of same thing. But my next kind of question for you was books. And of course, it's an O'Reilly book because it's very on brand for you.
Yeah. Like, this is where I'll say, like, for the record, I used to work at O'Reilly, right? O'Reilly.
Oh, really? Media. Okay.
Yeah. So that's also, I don't think I ever mentioned that to you. Okay.
No, you
yeah.
did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to work at O'Reilly Media as a data scientist, mostly focusing on machine learning, machine learning models and stuff, which meant that we had huge corpus. Corpus is like, you know, like a data set of like, written data and stuff like that.
You taught me that word the other day, corpus. Actually. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the plural of corpus is. It's not it's not corpuses. It's not corpi. It's corpa. Is the plural of corpus, if I remember that correctly. Or call it, say, corpi. I think corpi sounds more fun.
It sounds cute, like a little animal.
Corpi.
Yeah, a little baby corpi.
Yeah.
Sorry,
go.
Thumbnail, like a YouTube thumbnail. That's the bane of my existence. It's the worst thumbnail you'll ever see, but it's got two O'Reilly books, and one is Fundamentals of Deep Learning and the other one is Thoughtful Machine Learning.
I think I have both of those. Actually, which edition of Fundamentals of Deep Learning?
Mate, I have no idea. You'll know by nice. On site, right?
I think it's the second edition, yeah. Yeah. on the left.
It's
nice.
Yeah, I'm no graphic artist.
Now I want to pull it up real quick. I want to see if I can. I won't unless I can find it in the like 30 seconds. I might have too many books. The problem is I shifted all of my books to, and I'm like, oh, where do they all go?
My last kind of question. Was about Charlie's Angels. My last question for this episode, I guess, was at what, like, hypothetically, how do you feel about, you've seen, like, Rewind, have you seen the AI hardware, like the Humane Pin Rabbit?
Oh. Yes.
Uh-huh. Like all of that sort of stuff. Like, where do you see, like, it's the year is what? The year is 2034. What are you doing? How does your life look?
Well, I'm realizing I'm older. I'm probably going to have to get glasses finally. Speaking, sorry, I started going like my mortality. thinking more about, like kind of like you're saying, like, where does AI kind of go from here?
Yeah.
Like here? Yeah. So this is where I don't know if this is where things will be in, let's say, 5-10 years. I also don't know, like, if I'm being honest, I don't even know. I'll say my hot take on, like, large language models, which is tough because I'm in this space. I don't think large language models is the end all be all of where we're going into AI. I don't think I've heard people say literally, oh, if we just make large language models more powerful, better, you know, more compute, more data, we'll have, you know, human level intelligence. I don't believe that. Just based on like how they function and stuff like this, they're really great at finding patterns, but I don't think that is, how do I say this, is sufficient enough to actually have something where, you know, this is where people wave the hands, AGI or, you know, human level intelligence and or super intelligence and stuff like this. But, and the reason why I say this real quick is because I argue that large language models are not even at like animal intelligence, you know, or insect intelligence. Like, I think there's a lot of things there. It's good at finding patterns, but it feels more impressive because it's language, which always is really good. And it's really useful too. I don't do that. But that's kind of like my little take on there for like 10 years from now, which, you know, obviously I work in this field. So it's kind of like, oh, in 10 years from now. But also, you know, 10 years ago, we had different architectures too that we, you know, we can still use and are fine useful, but they're not the thing that is you know, bleeding edge or, you know, pushing, you know, new abilities and stuff like this.
The fax machine.
Well, like, even I'm even thinking about, like, just in the past 10, 15 years of, like, machine learning and data science and stuff too. Mm-hmm. But fax machine is an interesting one. Okay, I gotta say this. Fax machines were invented before the telephone. Which is just insane. Don't fact check me on that. No, you can fact check me. I actually want to make sure that's correct, but I'm pretty sure that's true. I think it's like by like a couple years. It's not by much, but I need to look this, make sure.
Yeah, yeah. 1843. The telephone invented 1876.
So ancient technology, like even older than the telephone, landline and stuff like that. Yeah, and what's crazy is fax machines are still have their specific use case. But
I didn't realize you loved fax machines so much. Like,
you know, technology, you know, like yeah, that and the cotton gin, you know, in the US was a big deal, you know. Like, no. Anyway, I realize also this is very US centric, like education. Like, the cotton gin is just like taught so much in history class of being like a huge technology. Exactly. Because it was a big deal in the US of like the Industrial Revolution. It's kind of like where it comes from. It's not important.
Okay.
But going back to your question about like 10 years, like, you know, like these, like human, you focus on the human thing. I've talked about how I could see something where, and I'm not saying essentially large language models, but I could see something that, instead of having a, like, you download an app on your phone, you could have something where you're like, oh, I want to, you know, like, oh, I need to set a timer for, you know, I have a timer that something's going to happen in like 20 minutes. So I want to set a timer. So you tell your phone, hey, you know, can you set me a timer? And this is obviously making it much more complicated than it needs to be. But I could imagine something where like an AI or a system actually build an app on the fly, essentially, to do the thing that happens. I don't think we're there. I don't even think necessarily what we have now is like, we're almost there. We just got to figure out a few quirks and stuff like this. I think it's like, oh, there's a huge amount of challenges. But I can see something like this being desirable and people wanting to build this and trying to find ways to make that happen. And I think in 10 years, it's hard to tell exactly where technology moves towards, but I do think like that's something that people have seen little hints of like what this could look like, and people want to build this. So, and I think it'd be pretty cool being able to like essentially have a real intelligent, like a smart assistant on your phone and not just like a pre-canned kind of thing. So I don't know. I don't know if that can answer
it. It's really, yeah, it's really interesting that you said phone though, like.
Yeah, like
I think we're so when I've spoken to people about different hardware, and there's such a focus on, there's so much needed to actually for adoption and for changing minds, or for this, what is it, that chasm of, I don't know what it's called. Anyway, crossing the chasm, right?
Yeah,
so it's like,
yeah,
think about the way that we give feedback as users to software is all like it's touch, it's like swiping, it's all of that kind of heat mapping stuff. You can't do that if it's something that's voice only, or if it's something that's a non, I don't know the word for that.
Like the interface and stuff, yeah, like that, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a completely different thing to think about. I think there's a lot more, like, I feel like there's people building that are like, this is the new way of everything. And it's like, people are so stuck on, because we've come through such a trauma with COVID that it's like, everything, what is this? It's like, I should have found it already. It's like a definition of traumaism. Someone was saying to me yesterday that it's like when you're completely destabilized in your reality. And I think that happened for a lot of people, like no matter how they feel about COVID, and it's like you trying to get back to baseline. So I think potentially adoption of new tech is going to be even harder, because it's like, I just want to be on my phone. I just want to have my iPad and my things that I understand. I don't want to be the Jetsons.
So a couple things you mentioned about, you called out me saying like a phone, right? Because it's like, oh yeah, there's no reason to it to be a phone. But it's funny too, is because you're always stuck with thinking about the future in terms of your current, present, and past. And so like, but I think it's funny, it's like, I do wonder how much like the phone structure is really ideal with the technology that we have, and like just like manufacturing and stuff. And the funny thing is, I think about it, is that I call it a phone, but like most of the things I do with my phone is not using it as a phone, right? It's doing everything else. And even before, you know, like what, like less than 10 years ago, we would be calling it, maybe more than 10 years ago, getting older, I realize, smartphones, right? We used to say, oh, there's a smartphone and it's a phone, right? Or a cell phone and a smartphone. And now we just call them phones because they're all smartphones and stuff like this. And so I wonder, there's a term, I'm not a biologist, so I'm going to say this wrong. Is it cancerification? It's this idea in biology that a lot of different animals have arrived at the crab body type plan. So there are true crabs that, like, you know, like crabs, like, you know, you think of a crab. And there's like false crabs, which are kind of other crustaceans, if I'm getting that right, that have basically evolved to look like crabs. And there's like a whole bunch of debate about like in biology, like, oh, why does this keep happening? Why is, you know, carcification, it's something with a C. That's all I can't rem I remember.
I've just found an article about it. I just typed in true crabs and false crabs.
Yep. It's like, yeah, oh, I know what you're looking for.
Like, I got you.
Yeah, convergent evolution. This is where I'm not a biologist, right? What is it called? It's killing me.
Oh, cost
Carcinization?
carcinization. There's
Carcinization.
gotta be like a biologist out there going, you dumb fuck.
Yeah, like honest, this guy can't even say carcinization.
Well,
I for the
there's a
record,
crab listening.
like, oh gosh, yeah. And the funny thing is, I could picture all the people talking about, like, I've seen articles and like videos talk about carcinization, and like I'm like, I can hear it, like seeing like them talk about the things, and I can't remember the specific word. I'm like, yep, I don't know what that word is. It's like completely, yeah, it's the crab thing. Anyway, you can, when I was teaching, when I used to teach science, sometimes I would lose words like that, and I'd be like, it's the thing, you know, and it'd be like, and the kids are like, what? And like, I can't remember, hold on a second. And they'd be like, what, you don't remember it? And it's like, I forget things. Like, you know, that's life. I know the concept, I just don't know the wordy things. But what I was trying to get at, carcinization is like, oh, like crab body types being kind of like evolved towards there. And I kind of wonder how much like maybe phones are kind of like, you know, people have tried doing kind of some weird stuff with phones, but it never really, at least so far, it hasn't really stuck. It's kind of like glass rectangle with a camera on the front and back with a touch screen. It's kind of like every like phone, every smart device and stuff. And even some people complain, like I've heard people complain about Macs being like, oh, why can't it be touch screen and stuff like this. And it's like, it's kind of like things are kind of evolving towards that direction. And I don't know, maybe, you know, there's something, some revolutionary idea, or what I think is more likely is the technology changes in such a way that it makes a new form factor viable. But I wonder if, like, oh, I wonder if smartphones, like, you know, the structure that we have today will basically be more or less the same in like 10, 15 years. Like, if I had to put money on it, I wouldn't bet too harshly against it. It's kind of
I
where
want
I'm
to pilot this with aliens because I
at.
feel like aliens would have access to a new form factor and a new technology, and I would like to run in parallel the adoption of software on phones and whatever they have. So this is a call to the aliens.
Real quick, are you thinking aliens like humanoid aliens, or like really far off, like different body type structure? Like, are we talking
You
about
know what's his
squids?
name? Is it Kang? You know, in The Simpsons, like, you
Yes,
know,
like
the two aliens in
the technical squid guy. Yes.
them. I feel like they're listening right now, and
Yeah.
they are going to do a pilot of smartphones. Well, smart. Oh my God, I'm aging myself now. Of phones, and whatever they have, which, yeah, I'm going to end the recording here.
That wraps up this week's episode of Unsupervised Learning. I'm your host, Renee, and I've had a great time chatting with you. As always, links to everything we discussed will be in the show notes. Make sure you reach out to our guests. For questions or feedback, reach out to pod@unsupervisedlearning.co. Until then, leave a like, follow, or rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And until next week, stay curious.